Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Hello, welcome everybody. Thank you for being here this afternoon. It is September 29th. A lot to talk about today, so we'll get right into it here in less than 2 minutes. We'll sit down with Alex, Jeff, and Kevin. We're going to give you a little education today during our market update. So we'll talk a little bit about what's going on in the market. We'll touch on the government shutdown. But also going to give you a little education on a mainstream-wise, probably little-known rule called the Taylor Rule. It's a bit of math that's used by economists and presumably the Fed to kind of validate where the Fed funds rate is and should be. And there's Stephen Miron put out an article about his calculation of the Taylor Rule and kind of validating why he believes that the Fed funds rate should be up to 2 points lower where it is than where it is today. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk about that here in a few minutes. And then after that, we will talk with Olivia Delancey, our Director of Communications and PR, and also the co-host of the Market Advantage podcast. So really excited to have her on. She was just at the Acuma conference here in Denver, and we'd like to talk to her about what she witnessed there and just kind of what is Acuma and you know, is it, you know, how does it relate back to what we all do in the mortgage industry? First, just in the way of data, OBMMI, conventional 30-year, 6.33. So we've ticked up a little bit from getting really close to 6%. 10 years at 4.14, might see a little volatility there around the government shutdown, but historically wouldn't expect big changes in rates there. We're still looking for that 6%, right? You get close to that 5 handle, and we should start to really see an uptick in volume, but we've already been seeing it. We've seen, especially in refis, some pretty good volume increases over the past couple of months now. So hopefully y'all are seeing that also. Not a big tick up in purchase volume, but that takes a little bit longer to get going, but certainly seeing some increase in refis. So yeah, let's go check in with the gang and see what's going on in the economy and with the Taylor Rule. Okay, welcome team. Welcome back. Good to be here. As always, there's no dearth of things for us to talk about. We were just getting started, so we decided we'd hit the record button and get back into it. So a few things on the headlines recently, a couple things that a little bit under the radar that we definitely want to cover today. Obviously, we have the possible government shutdown tomorrow night if a deal is not reached between the chambers. And every hour that goes by seems like less and less likely that something happens there. So there might not be much for us to talk about here other than an agreement needs to get made or the government will shut down and furloughs will start, like we've seen, the biggest one, 2018, during the previous Trump presidency. And not much happened with rates during that time, so we probably wouldn't expect much this time either, but who knows. Then we've got maybe the unemployment report on Friday, right? That could happen. Let's talk about that real quick here. I mean, if there's a government shutdown, it's very possible that the BLS will shut down. We won't get a report Friday, so we'll just, markets will operate as normal, and we'll get to it when the government reopens or the BLS figures out a way to get the report out. But what are we expecting? Does anybody have the numbers on that?
It's expected around 45,000.
So still pretty anemic in terms of historic numbers, but expecting the probably headline rate to remain low with some of the factors that we've talked about on the show, right?
Yes. Are they expecting the rate to tick up? I actually haven't looked at that. Or it's still at 4.3.
It ticked up last month with that massive revision. I don't think that there's an expectation for the actual unemployment rate to tick up again as well.
Yeah, as you said, Jim, is what we're looking at is probably the rate more because of all the different dynamics around immigration. You know, the number of jobs is just completely different baseline than what we're used to.
Right. We're just in a situation where the economy doesn't need to create a ton of new jobs to keep people gainfully employed, because we have just sort of a net reduction, or at least a net flattening of population growth with people leaving the country. And the people coming out of college or whatever, kind of replacing them. Interesting deal. Long term, it's not good. But for now, I guess it keeps that rate low enough where the Fed can kind of have their pick between focusing on inflation or focusing on jobs, or a little bit focusing probably on just general productivity and GDP right now. And that got us waxing a little bit about the Fed meeting a couple weeks ago, right? We didn't come around to much discussion around the newest addition to the FOMC, right? Myron, he had some interesting, he actually showed his work, if you will, on some of the decisions or some of his leanings. We were just chatting about that. I mean, where do we start with that, gentlemen? It was kind of refreshing, I think, to see someone show their work and not just come out from behind the curtain and say, it should have been a half point cut. I disagree with the rest of my colleagues, but he actually has some, I don't know, collegiate math behind his decision.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting. And also, I mean, he posted it on social media. He was kind of, discussing amongst folks. So it was interesting to see him out there in the public sphere, as someone who's now part of the Board of Governors for the Federal Reserve. So maybe just a quick backup. So Stephen Myron, we've talked about him a little bit on this podcast, just a reminder on who he is. So he had published a paper that shortly after Trump was elected, that was about restructuring the global, financial system. And it had a lot of Trump's, ideas, but was kind of this more academic approach to the policies that Trump was, looking to implement internationally with tariffs and things like that. He then quickly came on board as the chairman of the White House Economic Council, something like that. Whatever that thing is called in the White House with all the economists, he was the leader of that within the administration. And then he kind of had this unique jump over to the Federal Reserve when a seat opened up. And so sort of maybe straddles the line a little bit between, an economist, politician. I think the really interesting thing that he did was he from like a, pure economist standpoint, put out something last week, basically calling for the federal funds rate to be up to 2 points lower than it is currently, which is a huge, huge drop. And the way that he did that was by using something called the Taylor rule. Taylor rule is a formula that allows you to calculate what the federal funds rate should be. So I thought it would be interesting maybe today to walk the audience through, how can you calculate what the federal funds rate should be given, the current economic environment? And then also just kind of walk through some of Stephen Myron's arguments and, offer some feedback, some critiques about that. Maybe just to start it off, I had to, always gotta start with my math, with my handy dandy notebook. And so it's a really simple formula, really, when you look at it, but the Taylor rule is made up of these variables. So we're calculating I, which is the target federal funds rate. And the inputs to I are R star plus pi plus 1/2 times pi minus pi star plus 1/2 times y minus y star. And I'll break down what each of those variables mean and how we go into calculating it. So I here is what we're calculating, and that's the federal funds rate. And we can just sort of walk through these variables. And Alex, maybe you could help me out with some of the definitions. This R star here, this is our neutral rate. So this is going to be our rate of economic growth, assuming stable inflation and stable, you know, employment. So this is the ideal scenario for the Federal Reserve, where there's really nothing that they need to do. And so right now, that's calculated at about around 1%. So here we're already starting off at 1%. Next we have pi. So for whatever reason, they make inflation pi. So this has nothing to do with the
3.14. It's whatever inflation is.
You're right. It has nothing to do with the circumference of a circle or anything. But this is inflation. So now we're starting with, again, we've got 1% with our economic growth, and then inflation, which was 2.6 ish. So we're up to 3.6. And then we have, and this is kind of fancy, but it's really just, dividing by 2, the difference between inflation and then what the target is. So inflation is 2.6, the target, this pi star, is 2%. That's our target. So, and then we divide it by 2. And so that's, we're taking 2.6 minus 2 divided by 2, that's 0.3. So now we're up to 3.9. And then this last one is the output gap. So Alex, do you want to walk everyone through what the output gap means?
Sure. It's very similar to how you just explained inflation, but thinking about the target GDP, why representing a GDP metric there? The Y is going to be your GDP output as observed over the last 12 months, and then your GDP or Y star is going to be your expected GDP value. So for a developed economy in the first world, it generally comes out to about 2%.
Yep. Thank you. And so that's our output gap. It's basically a measure of how hot the economy is running versus what its potential is. And so most economists have this at 0.2. So again, we divide this by 2. That's a formula. So we're at 0.1. You add all these up, this 1, 2.6, 0.3, 0.1, and then you get 4. And that's essentially what the federal funds rate is. So that's basically how we use this model. And this isn't like the end all be all for the Federal Reserve, but this is something that they do use.
It's a theory. It's somebody's theory, right? And it's generally works out when you do the math.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just real quickly to maybe dumb that down a little bit, is the idea, especially kind of those last two terms, is our kind of averaging measurements of the economy overheating, whether it's through inflation or through output. Right. And so as you get higher numbers from overheating from either of those, you're going to have a higher interest rate, which is what we always talk about intuitively, raise rates when the economy is overheating, lower rates when, the economy is struggling, when we're not getting, a little bit of inflation or output growth.
Yep. I think that's a perfect way to put it is, is the economy overheating or is it underheating? Cooling.
So it's just a formulaic way to kind of get to some of those numbers that has kind of become mainstream in the economic community. It's a pretty good formulaic back in the napkin approach to figure out what a good interest rate is.
Yeah, a good way to test where we're at, I suppose. And in that case, with the numbers you just said, Kevin, we're perfect. But
yeah, and this is again, this is sort of what you would say, so that like the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, publishes some of these metrics, and so they're all sort of out there. They're referenced by existing Fed members and some of the things that they publish. But what was interesting was Stephen Miron went pretty deep on this, and we won't go like all the way down into some of the weeds and what he put together, but he put together his own Taylor rule, and he adjusted some of the numbers based on what he's seeing in terms of economic growth and inflation, and basically came up with a much lower number, around 2%, which would be substantially lower than what it is now. Now, keep in mind from our last episode, Stephen Miron sort of straddling that, like, you know, economist, politician, you know, there's one foot in each of those spaces. We talked a lot last week about we're trying to get interest rates down because we have all this debt that we want to, you know, roll over in the next year. And so, you know, potentially there's, you know, that's sort of filtering into the arguments, but I always appreciate someone who shows the math.
Yeah. And their rationalization, right? So obviously some of the numbers in here are not transparent. They're subjective. It's not just like go to the newspaper, pull out these numbers, and otherwise we'd all get the same answer, right? Stephen Miron's getting a very different answer by changing a couple of those numbers or seeing things like inflation very differently than what the headlines would suggest, right? Is that what we're saying?
Yep, 100%. And so let's walk through a couple of his arguments so that we can sort of, you know, understand his thinking and then see kind of where things go. So the first thing that he mentions is rental inflation is declining. So the way that we measure rental inflation, it's a lagging indicator, means it's more, you know, backward looking than really forward looking. And so his argument is current market rents are growing at around 1% annually, but the way that we measure inflation is still showing 3.5% based on, you know, stuff that's happened in the past. So that is a pretty big component of overall inflation, right? So he's saying that if we were to look forward to 2026, 2027, we would see that more at around 1%. And that could reduce our, if we just looked at what that long running inflation metric projected would be, that would reduce our headline inflation by about 0.3, 0.4 percentage points. And so that's one big argument on the inflation side. Another one is population growth, which Jim, you mentioned it already. The Pew Research, they've estimated 1.5 million immigrants have left the U.S. in the first half of the year. Stephen Miron, in his example, he suggests around 2 million in 2025 leave the U.S. entirely. And that would actually lower our potential growth, this R value, by 0.4 percentage points. So already we're getting close to a full percentage point below what where we're at. And so there's a few other examples that he talks about, the big, beautiful bill that was passed this summer and how deregulatory capabilities within the big, beautiful bill will expand our potential GDP, where, you know, now our output gap, instead of being positive, is actually negative because our potential economic growth is much greater because a lot of these policies within the big, beautiful bill and yada, 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 eventually you get to 2%.
Expansionary. Yeah.
It's a very, very interesting example. You know, I actually want to give him a lot of credit for putting this out there publicly. You know, I, you know, personally feel that, you know, in a world that's dominated by social media, you know, politicians, you know, being out there in public helps build trust in a way where, you know, if you're not really out there regularly engaging with the public and can sort of feel like you're in your, you know, ivory tower, if you will, and, you know, hiding behind bureaucracy or what have you. So the fact that he's out there engaging with folks, you know, definitely give him a lot of credit for.
Yeah, no, I think it's hopefully a bit of a trend. I think it is refreshing to see that. And it was something that was very, I mean, very well put together. There's already been some articles written that are in defense of the 4% versus his, you know, roughly 2% model. And I think you'll continue to see that, but hopefully that's again, a bit of a trend where a lot of these decisions are more made more transparent. So I think at the very least, it was fun to see that and try to wrap our own brains around that math. I don't know that anyone has invoked the Taylor rule in decades, maybe ever, publicly.
I think all these economists have some version of it. All the Fed governors have some offices have some version of it that they are using on the back end to figure out the expected. But yes, to so publicly talk about it was certainly interesting.
And to so publicly question the assumptions, I think it'll force the hand of anyone who disagrees to show their math, as Kevin's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think honestly that debate publicly is probably a good thing because, you know, there's sometimes when, you know, folks get things wrong. And so if you're out there having that debate publicly, I personally think that it's a net positive. But if I had to take a critical eye to some of the claims that are being made within the Taylor rule, you know, it might look something like the impression that I'm getting, at least, is let's just take the two examples that I went over. Rental inflation, you know, expected to decline. And then we're also, we talked about the population growth also declining. So the two items here are both contributing to a lower federal funds rate. My criticism might be that with rental inflation, which affects R, he's looking at a longer run variable, so a future variable, which there's some risk in doing that, you know, number one, but let's just sort of give him the benefit of the doubt here and say, okay, rental inflation does continue to decline. We end up in 2027 with 1%, you know, market rent growth. That's all well and good, but I've mixed these two up here. With the population growth declining, we're looking at today's value. So he's sort of mixing and matching. You know, we're going to look at a future value where it's going to, you know, help the federal funds rate get lower, but we're going to look at today's value in other places where it helps the federal funds rate go lower. But for instance, I don't think that anyone would say that it's economically sustainable long-term to have 2 million people leaving the country, you know, every year. That's obviously, that's a short-term phenomenon. It's probably going to level off at some point. And, you know, setting the policy rate to what's happening just this year may not make a lot of sense. So that's kind of like a full, you know, start to finish of, you know, Taylor rule. Had a chance to whip out my old CFA notebook, which actually does have, believe it or not, a lot of my writings from 12 years ago, and go through the Taylor rule, go through Stephen Miron, what he's talking about, you know, offer a little bit of criticism, but also I think a lot of praise for putting something out there. And I thought it was probably the most interesting economic news of last week.
Yeah. I mean, we obviously in this industry, we root for rates to be lower. And if, you know, we would like some of Myron's projections to be right, but they are just that, they're projections. And that's why some people are taking exception to his math, as you are. But it's possible that other members of the FOMC are, you know, taking kind of maybe a too present day look at the numbers. That's been mentioned before, right? Maybe you're not thinking enough ahead to get more in line with a Myron, or maybe something, you know, hopefully we get somewhere in the middle. And that tends to be the way these things go when you have an outlier. You start to pull the average a little bit closer as people are forced to, I don't know, check their math or start to maybe concede that maybe we are a little bit behind the eight ball.
Yeah, and I'll just add on to the point that you're making, Jim, which is which time period should the Fed be looking at when they're trying to set their rates? I don't know that that's something that's, you know, solidified.
One interesting anecdote just from the Cleveland Fed president spoke this, I think this morning, not a voting member, but she was just talking about how, you know, the labor market looks reasonably healthy and broadly in balance while inflation remains stubbornly high. And she doesn't see expected prices to fall back to 2% until 2027, 2028. You know, you have these very different views, you know, probably more different than we've ever had with Myron kind of pushing in the other direction. And maybe more classic economists with some of these views, like the Cleveland president. I'm also going to steal a line that I saw kind of broadly talking about the Fed from friend of the podcast, Chris Maloney from Bank of Oklahoma. He said the Fed is screeching like a hawk, but acting like a dove, right? We're still lowering. I mean, they are lowering interest rates, and presumably in a cycle where they were continued to low rates, not at the pace and levels that Myron is suggesting, but, you know, we have at least two more, you know, two rate cuts priced in through our two Fed announcements through the end of the year. So we have a lot of folks on the Fed saying things like the Cleveland president said, screeching like a hawk, but yeah, acting like a dove while continuing to lower rates. I thought those were a couple interesting anecdotes.
It is. It's like we're trying to will that inflation number lower, but meanwhile, we've proven time and time again that we're really bad at forecasting inflation and how stubborn it can be, right? I think that's what everybody's worried about. I believe even the administration is worried about it, but they're not letting on to that fact because they're really just pushing for that lower rate to see what happens. I think they're willing to take that risk, whereas the Fed is not, because they've got scars, right? I mean, it was 2022 through 24 were really bad. I don't think any of us have forgotten about that. That was amazing math lesson, Kevin. Thank you. I may have had some flashbacks of high school and college right there. But that makes all the sense in the world. I mean, you're really just, like you said, you're looking at growth versus potential growth and whether we have the brakes on or the gas on too much or too little. And then what's inflation going to look like? So those are the two projections that are out there. And then this big, beautiful bill is kind of built in there somewhere. And a lot of conjecture around that, apparently. I mean, it's one of the biggest spending bills that's ever existed. And we're kind of trying to predict what the effects of it are going to be in the medium run, right? 1.5 to 4 years in the future. And that's, Myron's putting, weighting that more so than potentially the other members of the FOMC. But again, maybe we should be somewhere in the middle of these two places. All right. Anything else on that? I mean, just, you know, look for other things, whether it's on social media or mainstream media, about inflation expectations, growth expectations, and people invoking the, mentioning the Taylor rule. Cause I think you'll start to maybe see more of that math out there, you know, on TikTok or whatever the young people are watching.
When it makes it to TikTok, then we know it's all over.
that's probably true. Then you got to watch out who posted that thing. So there's a lot of manipulation going on out there in the social media space, especially on the TikTok, from what I'm told.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Otherwise, yeah, we may have unemployment this week, may not. But if it does come out, it's the number to watch, right? If we see the unemployment rate tick up above 4.3, or we see a zero or negative job creation number, that really could change expectations for what we see in the October Fed meeting.
Yep. And if there is a shutdown, just lean on the ADP, the private payroll numbers that'll come out on Wednesday.
Right. So that will come out either way. Good call. That's been a little, I don't know, maybe a little bit more reliable lately, a little more indicative of BLS. It hasn't matched it nearly.
Yeah, I'd say like the first half of the year, it struggled to keep pace with the swings in the BLS number, but it's tightened up in the last few months. Historically, there have been periods where it's separated quite a bit.
And as far as the shutdown, history tells us we don't get much of a change in rates. Although the last time we got a few basis points lower, there's two forces acting, right? There's one that says the government is in a bit of turmoil, so yields should go up. And if it was any other country, that may be what happens. But because we're also kind of the safe haven, our treasuries are kind of a safe haven, you get people investing in treasuries and it kind of keeps that rate low. So again, I wouldn't expect, based on history, a ton of movement, but I wouldn't expect rates to jump nor plummet if and when the government shuts down Tuesday night. So be watching Tuesday night. If the chambers haven't figured it out by then and made come to an agreement, there will be furloughs. There will be headlines about it, but it's just, you know, if you're not a government worker, it's kind of, you know, wait and see how long it takes to get it all figured out. All right. Anything else? Any other big numbers we should be watching this week?
No, it's really just employment this week. There was some pending home sales this morning that were a little impressive. Just kind of rounding off the busy summer season with a 0.4% jump in August. But no, the biggest numbers this week will be employment for the full economy.
All right. Sounds good. Great catch up, gentlemen. Thanks for the time. Thanks for the wisdom.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. Awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, guys. Okay. As promised, Olivia Delancey, Optimal Blue's Director of Communications and PR. Welcome, Olivia. Good to have you on here.
Hey, Jim. Good to see you. It was also great to see you in person last week.
Yes. Yes. That's what we're here to talk about, right? You came out to the Acuma conference. So if many of our listeners are not aware, Acuma is a trade organization, a kind of like the MBA for credit unions is how I think about them, right? It's the American Credit Union Mortgage Association. And they had their annual conference. It's one of those that moves around, kind of like the MBA conferences, but it was here in Denver. Olivia attended and spoke on a panel. And I believe this is your first time attending that conference. Second time attending that conference. So we just wanted to have you on to give some observations, right? I mean, we attend that conference pretty aggressively over the years. We have really good relationships with a lot of credit unions. It's honestly an area I'd like to focus on more. And I think we're going to continue to kind of ramp up our ability to better support credit unions through our pricing engine, but also our hedging software, you know, on the desk where I reside. So I've always thought that there is just a bit of a separation between like the IMB, the Independent Mortgage Bank, and then banks and credit unions on the other side. Right. And we're all producing the same things. We're producing mortgage loans. We're supporting our customers through purchases and refis, you know, and supporting in that way, we're supporting homeownership. We're also supporting just affordability and ways to unlock equity and things like that. But I feel like the IMBs and the credit unions go about things very differently. And I've always felt that they could, I don't know, collaborate more with one another. And I'll get to that here in a little bit. But just so listeners and we kind of understand what happens at these things, like what did you observe and what were any of your takeaways from the conference?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. The Acuba event is actually one of my favorites, and I really like the credit union group, and I'll tell you why. They're all about collaboration and relationships and community. So credit unions are really big on best practice sharing. They don't like to hoard knowledge. They're not competitive. They learn something and they immediately want to share that knowledge with one another to help, you know, the next person do the same thing, succeed alongside them. And you definitely feel that at these events. It's kind of like stepping into a community. I actually noted a quote that I saw online in relation to this event. So it was like 600 mortgage professionals who feel more like coworkers than competitors. And on that note, there were over 600 people at the event, and it was actually the best attended Acuma annual event on record. So that tells you a lot. These credit union mortgage professionals really value what they get out of attending this event. And we'll see, maybe next year will be another record-setting year. So a few other observations and things I heard. People really valued the sessions because they felt like they were hearing practical knowledge. There's a big focus on regulations and compliance within the credit union world, huge focus on the member experience. So whereas on the other side of the fence, we hear a lot about profitability, operational efficiency, credit unions are all about that member relationship, serving the member, serving their communities. Just really interesting to hear the different conversations that come along with that. So the panel that I got to sit on, which was a lot of fun, by the way, was about marketing. So it was focused on the sales side of the house. So the credit union loan officer and how they are essentially putting their personal brand out there to reach members in the community. And apparently there is a large challenge among this group about kind of getting in their own way. So they're a little too worried about, am I going to step out of regulatory bounds? Am I going to say the wrong thing? I don't know what type of content to produce. Where do I start? I'm not a professional marketer. So what I really stepped into that panel hoping to bring was a content perspective, because that's my background. So my advice there was start with what you know. You don't have to be an expert in any of these things. Just think about what your target audience is asking you day to day and go from there. So it was a lot of fun. I hope that the audience got something out of our session. I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed the whole event. Was super, super happy to attend. And especially, you know, a chance to come to Denver is always, always welcomed for sure. And great to see you and your group too. So
sure. No, that's great. I think, you know, I know you and I were talking in the office about your session. I think you definitely brought a good amount of wisdom there, and you've got a good kind of view of all the different types of mortgage lenders that are out there. And you can bring that, some of that, I don't know, that knowledge or some of those strategies into that marketing conversation. Cause I think, and this might be a controversial take, but I think that the independent mortgage banks could learn a thing or two from the credit unions. I think collaboration is a huge one that you hit on earlier, right? I think in the IMB space, and maybe rightfully so, there's a bit more of isolationism, right? They don't want to share their ideas with the competitor, but at the same time, a rising tide lifts all boats, right? We could all be more efficient if we all kind of shared what works and what doesn't. And we see that, you know, it depends on, like, we have our events, we have our summit coming up here in February. And that's an event where I've certainly witnessed all types of clients getting together and collaborating and kind of letting their guard down, right? In that sort of venue. Whereas probably when they leave, they go back to, they grab their shields and their swords and they're fighting with each other, right? But again, feels like something where the credit unions maybe have it right, where they're, when they find something that makes sense or that works, whether it's a strategy or a piece of software or another piece of their arsenal, they're sharing it with their competitors. And at the same time, I think credit unions could learn some things from the IMBs, right? The IMBs focus solely, most of them, solely on mortgage lending, right? Purchase refi business, bringing it in the door, getting it done efficiently. Whereas credit unions, a lot of times, a credit union has many different products they sell to their members, very focused on the experience, but maybe don't focus enough on mortgage, or maybe that division kind of finds themselves jockeying for position or resources or funds or focus, and they could maybe learn some things from the IMB community. That's not going to happen as much at an Acuma. Acuma is kind of where you go with your peers, and 600 people is an enormous conference to learn just the best of the best that people are operating on in the credit union space. But you come to something like a summit, like our event, and you can rub elbows with folks of just totally different structures and strategies. So I think that's, you probably want to be, if you can swing it, you probably want to be doing all those things. You wanted to go to major mortgage industry conferences as well as some of this credit union stuff. So yeah, you kind of validated, have we felt on the desk about this? Because we have all types of clients that we work with hedging, right? We have tons of IMBs. A majority of our clients are IMBs because they're looking to be as efficient and maximize profitability and maximize margin strategies and things like this. So they're all delivering mandatory and hedging their pipeline, whereas credit unions tend to be a little bit more conservative. So some of them, you know, you say the word hedging and they're a little bit worried that maybe it's risky. If done right, it's not. That's kind of the point of hedging, is that you're remaining neutral, right? So we have, over the years, we have a higher and higher percentage of credit union customers that work with us on our trade desk, because they've been sharing that strategy amongst themselves, amongst the other credit unions, and really starting to adopt more of our software, from our PPE down, you know, also to our capital markets solutions.
Jim, we had a few representatives from the hedging and trading desk join us at a client dinner. So it's nice to have, it's nice to have hedging and trading represented among the credit union dinner. So
beautiful. Yeah. I heard it was a real nice dinner right down the street again from our office in Denver. And yeah, I mean, that's to me the biggest piece of working with OB or working with your hedge provider, who, you know, with your vendor, with your partners, is that relationship, right? The relationship piece, and having, you know, sitting down, having a meal with somebody is sometimes the best way to connect with them, or to know what they need, or to, you know, have a constructive conversation. And also, again, these dinners were very collaborative. Folks are sitting next to their competitors and having reasonable kind of guard down conversations.
So I think that the advice here, credit unions, is if you are not registered for our summit yet, you should come and show our other types of lenders what that means to really be collaborative and relationship oriented, and maybe learn a few things along the way that you can take back to your credit union peers.
That's, you know, I think conferences have sort of, in my mind, have morphed over the years, and you know, the sessions and everything are great in terms of taking notes and getting good education, but a huge part of them is just being in one place at one time in person, which is something that we lost, like during the pandemic, for instance. And when we came back, it feels like there was more of this hunger to get out there and meet with other folks that are in the same business you are, and finding out what they're doing and how it's working for them. Cause, you know, especially in the technology space, it moves so quickly and evolves so quickly. You really want to be sure you're not missing any opportunities.
That's right.
All right. Olivia, thank you so much. Olivia, Director of Communications and PR and co-host of the Market Advantage podcast. Please do check that out if you haven't. That comes out once a month along with our Market Advantage report. And we will see you again soon, Olivia. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jim. See you next time.
Wow. Another great episode. Let's wrap this thing up. Big thanks to Alex, Jeff, Kevin, and Olivia. Great episode, great content, great insight. Appreciate you all being on. Appreciate everybody listening. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.